This is Michael Gilmore. I wrote the article, Why the Beatles Broke Up, for Rolling Stone magazine.
By the time the Beatles gathered in January 1969, you wrote in this article that there was a fundamental difference between how John Lennon viewed the Beatles and how Paul McCartney viewed it. Could you elaborate on that?
In January 1969, when the Beatles gathered in a film studio to begin the work for what became the Let It Be album, but then was known as the Get Back sessions, there were distinct differences between John Lennon and Paul McCartney about the fundamental reasons and purposes of the Beatles, and I think George Harrison has some differences as well. Paul McCartney saw it pretty much as it had, as the unit had been for the last 10 years, as a creative and cooperative unit working together to discover new musical purposes. John Lennon, I think, began to see it as a more loose form unit that could gather intermittently to serve his purposes, but he was also on the verge of beginning a solo career, and he knew that. George Harrison, I think, had tired of the Beatles in 1966 and had been looking for some reason for the group to come apart. It's pretty evident in the documentation of January 1969 that George Harrison was a constant irritant in those sessions to both Lennon and McCartney, and became an obstructionist in the process, including a period where he walked out of the band for about 10 days.
Yeah, let's elaborate on that a bit. Because of the film where there was this sort of famous showdown between McCartney and Harrison, or a little rub anyway, people think of it that being the chief tension. But you write that Harrison and Lennon also clashed. Can you talk a little bit about their being at odds with each other at that time?
Sure. In the film of Let It Be, there's a famous scene in which George Harrison and Paul McCartney are rehearsing parts to a song that Paul's written, and Harrison becomes visibly impatient with Paul. He tells him, "I'll play what you want, or I won't play anything at all." And in the booklet that originally came with Let It Be, that conversation went on a bit and was clearly a more volatile conversation than the scene in the film. That's often been understood and represented as the schism that drove George Harrison out of the band in January for about 10 days. But that isn't the way it truly developed. That George Harrison left the band, I believe, on January 10th, and that conflict between McCartney had already happened a day or two before then. The real conflict in the band at that time was between George Harrison and John Lennon. The eruptive fight that they had, according to George Martin, actually came to blows, was one of the few moments not captured in all the recordings during that month of the Let It Be sessions. But my best guess is that it was a conflict over the presence of Yoko Ono at the sessions. She had become inseparable from John. She contributed comments and criticism about the music, which I know irritated both George and Paul, but also she had seemed to take a place in the Beatles, and George Harrison, who had been in the back seat for so long, had to find that truly discouraging. George was already of a sort of depressive nature, and just as his songwriting was beginning to bloom, to find himself in less of a power position had to be terribly disappointing and unsettling for him. And I think that was the source of the conflict that occurred between him and John Lennon, and that caused George to walk out for so long. Mm-hmm.
You also write that Lennon and Harrison treated McCartney, you write, shamefully during 1969 and unforgivably in the early months of 1970.
I think the greater problem, though, occurred within the dynamics of the four Beatles themselves. As Yoko Ono herself said at one point, they were too strong as people and too strong as a unit for an outside element to defeat them and to defeat their unity. George Harrison had tired of the Beatles. John Lennon was going through a range of emotions and desires and intentions. And an argument was building about who should manage both the group and their business firm at that point, Apple, which essentially was handling not their recordings, but the recordings of other bands that they signed. But it was also the distributor for the Beatles. And it was their company. It had come out of Paul's vision as sort of an experimentalist socialist company, but it was beginning to collapse for all the good old capitalist reasons. And so there was a lot of anxiety about who would handle the Beatles and who essentially would save their fortune. And Lennon and Harrison put a great deal of pressure on Paul McCartney to accept Alan Klein, an accountant from New York who had managed the Beatles, who had managed the Rolling Stones, among other artists, but had a somewhat shady reputation. McCartney wanted his girlfriend's father, his girlfriend was Linda Eastman, her father was Lee Eastman, a well-respected manager and attorney working out of New York. And the conflict went deep to the heart of everything that was pulling the Beatles apart, issues about whether they should be a rough-and-tumble outfit or a sophisticated outfit, issues about the directions they should follow, issues about whether they should see themselves as a conceptual band or as a loose-form band. And as that developed, I mean, clearly in hindsight, McCartney had better instincts than Lennon or Harrison, and it was Lennon who drove the band into Alan Klein's arms. And in the process of that, Lennon and Harrison and Ringo Starr too put a great deal of pressure on McCartney about Alan Klein to the degree that they essentially told him he would have to accept Alan Klein as a manager regardless of his feelings, and they signed a contract with Klein, though McCartney declined to put his signature on it. Just about at the same time that contract was being signed, John Lennon announced he was leaving the group. So Paul McCartney found himself bound to a group that was coming apart and a business that he did not want to be aligned in with Alan Klein. So that combination of pressures, plus so many other internal conflicts between Lennon and McCartney, began the real end game of the Beatles' days.
But Lennon did not make that announcement publicly at the time. This was like September 69.
Right.
Yeah.
About this same time, John Lennon announced that he was going to leave the Beatles, that he wanted a divorce, that he had just played a show with Yoko Ono in Toronto, Canada. He was inspired by it. It was the sort of music he said he now wanted to make. And he was fed up with the Beatles. And he was fed up with the Beatles primarily, he said, because of Paul McCartney and just how essentially creative McCartney had been, writing too many songs, directing the band's music for too long. And he wanted he felt that McCartney was making music softer. He called it, I think he called it something like grandmother music. Lennon called it grandmother music. And he announced he was going to leave the band in September 1969. But both McCartney and Alan Klein convinced him not to announce that publicly because they were still in the process of negotiations about contracts. And also, I think both of them believed that Lennon would change his mind because he was capricious. He changed his mind all the time about things. So Lennon withheld that announcement publicly. It had come out in bits and pieces in some of the music press, but it was not widely known that Lennon said in September of 1969 that he planned to leave the Beatles.
And then ultimately, remind listeners about whether the Alan Klein association really worked out for the band.
After the end of the Beatles, John Lennon, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr remained signed as Beatles and as individual artists to Alan Klein. Paul McCartney sued in the courts to dissolve his relationship with Alan Klein, though he couldn't sue Klein, he could only sue the Beatles. And to put it briefly, McCartney prevailed. But Lennon, Harrison, and Starr stayed with Klein, and at first it seemed to serve them at least well. George Harrison went on to stage The Benefit for Bangladesh, which became a successful film and movie and a model for how well-organized rock and roll concerts could work as charity events. Ringo Starr went on to have solo hits. John Lennon made two wonderful albums that one of which produced one of his biggest hits, Imagine, and things seemed well. And ironically, it took McCartney a little longer to get on his feet in his solo career. But after those points, it was more or less, not, I wouldn't say it was over for Lennon McCartney, and for Lennon, Harrison, and Starr, but a great deal of the creativity had been expended. And it's interesting that almost all the songs that made those albums so popular, such as Harrison's All Things Must Pass and Lennon's first album and his Imagine album, were songs that were written during their period with the Beatles, in more or less in that last year. And some of them written in the presence of Paul McCartney and probably with his help in developing them. After a few years, the relationship began to sour with Alan Klein and the others. I think they began to see Alan Klein as somebody who didn't have any creative vision. And Alan Klein began to become critical of the music that Yoko Ono was making. It was, her albums were expensive to make, and they did not sell. And parenthetically, I'll say that for my vantage, they were actually quite good albums. But he became critical of her, and becoming critical of Yoko Ono in Lennon's eyes was unacceptable, and probably was in Yoko Ono's eyes as well. So they soured on him, and when they soured on him, the others did too. I think at that point, Harrison and Starr still tended to take their lead from John Lennon. And when Lennon and Klein parted, because that was the main party in that relationship among the Beatles and Klein, when they parted, it was not under kind. It wasn't under publicly acerbic terms, but it was tense. It was a tense parting, and eventually, the remaining Beatles ended up suing Klein for how he had handled their business during those years.
Let me go back to their state of mind in January. One thing that brought them together was this notion that they might play live again. What led to the Beatles even thinking about playing live again when they were gathering together in January?
In January 1969, when the Beatles were working on the Get Back sessions, they had originally formed to during that month for the purpose of rehearsing for a live concert. They had not played live since September 1966, at the end of the of a United States tour. And that tour of 1966 had been so disheartening for them, not in terms of success, but because it had been a rather dangerous tour. They'd been threatened a lot on the tour, and they had stirred up a lot of controversy. And all the Beatles, but I think McCartney, wanted to pull off the road. And when McCartney began to see how dangerous it was becoming, he agreed. And so after September 1966, they didn't perform live before an audience until some point, I believe it was around November 1968, but that, I might be wrong about that, until some point where they played a show for David Frost's British TV program that had a live audience before them, as they performed Hey Jude and Revolution, which the two songs made the two sides of a new single for them. I think they were nervous going into it because the audience not only was sitting in front of them, but the audience would join them on the stage and form the chorus for Hey Jude. But they also came out of it thoroughly exhilarated, I think Lennon in particular, and they wanted to resume live shows. They wanted to try a live show or two and see how it went. By the time they got into the studio in January, any of that enthusiasm was dissipated. Lennon was using drugs heavily, and he just sort of languished during that time. George Harrison had whole different ideas about what the Beatles should be by that point, and he clearly did not want to do a live show. That was one of the reasons why he pulled out, left the band for 10 days, because he was so opposed to the possibility of doing a live show that it became a daily obstruction in their rehearsals. So whatever that ideal was to perform live that had ignited them a couple of months before was extinguished by the time they gathered in 1969, early 1969, to rehearse for a live show. And interestingly and ironically, in September 1969, it was that same issue in a business meeting among the Beatles and Alan Klein that provoked Lennon to say that he was leaving the Beatles. Paul McCartney again wanted to perform live and wanted the band to undertake a tour, perhaps in small clubs anonymously, and that was what finally drove Lennon over the edge. He said, I'm just not a Beatle anymore.
Mm-hmm. So the sequence is that you write that January 10th, Lennon and Harrison have this fight, and Harrison walks out. But 2 days later, Sunday, January 12th, all four Beatles are at Ringo Starr's house trying to patch up differences. Remind us what went on at that January 12th meeting.
2 days after George Harrison left the band on January 12th, 1969, which was a Sunday, all the Beatles gathered at Ringo Starr's house to see if they could work out the differences. And the differences primarily were differences that George had with the purposes of these rehearsals. He did not want to play a live concert. He certainly did not want to play in any grand or exotic location, as had been discussed. They talked about playing in an amphitheater in I believe, Libya. They had talked about playing large stages in London. And he had just remained opposed to that. He had hated Beatlemania. George Harrison, I think, never really liked the audience that the Beatles attracted and did not want to go back to that state of things. He also felt that he had taken something of a backseat to Yoko Ono after she had joined John Lennon. In essence, she joined the band, and Harrison's standing went down a rung or two. These were among the issues that they discussed that day at Ringo's, but John Lennon apparently at that meeting would not speak for himself, and Yoko was speaking for him, which irritated George to no end. It irritated all the Beatles that John had become so passive, that Yoko had become active in his place. But it particularly irritated George for reasons I just summed up. So George stormed out. I don't know how long the meeting went. It wasn't recorded. I think it was sometime later before anybody admitted what had happened during that meeting. But George stormed out again. And it took several days more to work out the differences.
Well, how did they convince him to come back? You say it was 2 weeks later that they decided to meet in the basement of Apple headquarters and record again. What happened in the interim?
The other Beatles, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, and Ringo Starr, finally convinced George Harrison to return so they could finish the work they were doing. But much of it occurred under George's stipulations. He no longer wanted to play in Twickenham Film Studios because it was vast, it was cold, it was impersonal, and he wanted them to play in their own studio that they were building, which ironically was not finished. He also wanted them to abandon all talk of any major live concert performance. He had wanted basically to relegate Yoko Ono to a sound booth or to keep her out of the recording sessions, but John Lennon was not going to allow that to happen. So it was a compromise of sorts. But George, in many ways, won the bigger battle. They moved into, and in winning that battle, it completely changed what those sessions were. They were no longer rehearsals for a live show. They were now recording sessions for a possible album. When George returned, he brought with him organist Billy Preston, whom the Beatles had known for some time, and who had played with Ray Charles, among others. And Preston's musicianship and his ability to improvise inspired the Beatles as a musical unit to hold together, to behave in a better way with another musician. And they were able, finally, to pull off some tracks that eventually were worked into the shape for the Let It Be album.
But they do continue filming. Maybe one concession to George was, or to the other Beatles, was that they would continue to film. And you write that the director was kind of, prompting the Beatles to suggest some sort of ending to the film. So it's very late in the month. It's January 29th when an idea starts to percolate how to wrap this filming up. Can you talk a little bit about how that process happened that led to the rooftop concert?
The Beatles brought in Michael Lindsay Hogg, a director they had worked with previously when they made their videos of the singles Paperback Writer and Rain. And Lindsay Hogg had also worked with the Rolling Stones for a TV special. And he came in to direct the film, to give it some form, to mainly handle the camera work so it wouldn't be as obtrusive, though it was clearly obtrusive to the point that it irritated George Harrison all the time. Now, the director did some funny and interesting things, some of which were good and some of which were detrimental. The detrimental parts was he tried, because he was conscious of making a film, he wanted it to have a flow and an ending, and the original idea was to build up to a grand concert. So he kept trying to push that idea and impose the idea on the sessions, so, essentially so that he could begin the work to stage it, because it wasn't something that could happen overnight, which is, in fact, what did happen later. But Harrison, again, was just so resistant to it that those ideas could go nowhere. And at the point that Harrison walked out of the band, Lindsay Hogg suggested bringing Harrison back for a concert and then announcing at the end of the concert that the Beatles were no more. But Lennon and McCartney were not fond of that idea. So the problem remained what to do with the film. They kept filming once they moved into a smaller studio. It had originally started as the idea of a TV documentary that would have preceded a TV broadcast of the concert. But since that was no longer going to happen, and since what they had seemed kind of formless, they needed an ending. And at some point in late January, it was probably Paul McCartney, though I've also heard that Ringo Starr made the suggestion, so, and I think Lindsay Hogg claims the credit for it. Somebody suggested the Beatles go up on the rooftop of the Apple building in London and perform live in an unannounced setting, and that could make for a dramatic and effective ending, which in fact it did.
Well, when you wrote a paragraph or two about that, talk a little bit about, you know, your impressions of watching that, and I think tying it into this notion that you also wrote about on your weblog, that something transcended the acrimony and strife, you know, in the end. What did your research clarify for you about that notion, and maybe tying it into what you saw with the concert?
Let It Be was, by any fair account, a pretty miserable film. It's not filmed that well. It's it is formless. The moments that are clearly played for the camera are awkward, and a lot of the other moments are uncomfortable. The great moment in the film became also the great moment for the Beatles at the end of their career when they performed on the rooftop at Apple. And they were reluctant to go on stage up to the last moment, particularly George. And John Lennon had been reluctant, but then finally he said, let's just do it. So they went on stage. They performed, I guess, for about 45 minutes. They did some of the songs a couple of times. But I think that once the Beatles were together playing music, they could not help but be the Beatles. They had done that for so long in so many settings. And they knew each other so well that when essentially the pressure was on, they knew how to click. Those are great performances for the most part. I've always wished that they would release the entirety of those performances, because they make for a valid album. All four of them were better, much better than Competent, which is pretty much all they had been up to that point during that month. They were inspired. They were on fire. They make great music together, and I think in those moments they loved one another, and they loved the language that they could speak to each other through music. It was everything else once that ended, when they were not making music together, that formed that network of problems that ended the Beatles. And ironically, that more or less started in a day or two after that concert, because right before then, John Lennon had met Alan Klein and was starting to bring Alan Klein into the Beatles business.
Yeah, and it strikes me, too, that, you know, there's something that happens when a band like that that hasn't played together in a long time, they're actually playing in front, of course, at first only about, I don't know, 25, 30 people before, you know, some other people get to a place where they can see the band. But I guess it doesn't take much in terms of playing in front of people that pulls a band's energy together. I mean, except for the haircuts, you know, you could kind of watch their faces and sort of see the same sort of thing you saw on the films of the Ed Sullivan Show.
I think one of the things that's apparent in the filming the Let It Be sessions is that these aren't really the Beatles at this point. These are men with different ideas and with apparent tensions between each other. At one point, Paul McCartney said, "Why can't we just be the cooperative unit we were before?" And George Harrison said, "If you want somebody else to cooperate with you, find somebody else." It was pretty plain that that spirit had left them. But I think when they were playing live, for one thing, their legacies are on the line in those moments. They are, whether it's 20 or 30 people or thousands of people, they are live. It is being filmed. It is for posterity, and the pressures of that, plus that kind of collective memory of what they were as a band, clicked in, and it worked for them. Whether it could have worked longer, that certainly McCartney thought it could. But the others had no interest past that one brief performance.
Right. Well, I want to be sensitive to time here. I just want to open the door for, you know, and of course Abbey Road is a whole different story, even though Abbey Road, much of the material was recorded in that same period of time, or at least songs began to take shape. But what is important for people to remember about how the Beatles moved from all this tension and distrust in January, late January of 1969, to be able to pull off Abbey Road? What are some highlights from that time that are important to underline?
Abbey Road is sort of the Beatles' miracle in some ways. Lennon would later more or less renounce the album because he thought it had too much artifice in the way that the suite was put together by Paul McCartney and producer George Martin. But that suite works beautifully and it holds up well, and it holds up well as a farewell testament of music from them. And this was one of those moments when Lennon himself again had the best moments on the album, as reluctant as he may have been. Come Together and She's So Heavy are pretty remarkable pieces of music, and they outweigh anything else on that record, including George Harrison's Something, which is also a pretty remarkable piece of music. But Lennon's work is a lot riskier, and it was a direction one hoped he would go in, but never really did once he left the Beatles. But as I say, that album was their miracle. They knew on some level that all this was coming apart. Lennon hadn't announced yet that he was going to leave the group, but the tensions had grown too high. They'd had raging fights about the management question of Alan Klein. And yet they also had all these songs that they had worked on during the Let It Be sessions that they had not recorded, had not developed further. And they knew that these songs could best be accomplished with each other. They did have this innate understanding of what they brought to each other in the music, even if they didn't necessarily like the music of the other person. They knew they could serve each other's music well, and they knew that they could serve the Beatles well. So though there were a lot of problems during Abbey Road, much more than is widely acknowledged, it was hardly the peaceful period of time and work that the myth has it to be. It is a work of true transcendence. These men had to transcend themselves. They had to transcend the fate that they knew was coming. They had to recognize in each other the qualities that had made them proud to make music together. And that is a large part of what comes across in Abbey Road. But I would also say, even though I give Lennon credit for the two standalone songs that were so great on the album, Come Together and She's So Heavy. I would also say that it was Paul McCartney's triumph in the end. It was his vision for that suite. And I think in that suite, and in a couple of very poignant and powerful places, Paul McCartney is talking to John Lennon and to the other Beatles about their fate, about what they are leaving behind, and what they will have to live with. He said at one point that in that song, The End, when which becomes The Weight, he said that you're going to have to carry that weight for a long time. He later said that he meant that. He meant that this is the burden of this, the accomplishment and the guilt of how this ends is something that we will all have to live with.
Well, let me ask you to say a little bit about, if you know from your research, it didn't really pop up in your article much, but there is this myth that they came together and worked smoothly to pull this album off. Are there eyewitnesses or a story or two that you know, that suggest differently?
There is this prevailing notion that in contrast to making the White Album, which had been apparently a tense process to the degree that McCartney called it the tension album, and in contrast to the Let It Be sessions, which had been messy and without much direction or point until the very end, there's a notion that they, in overcoming so much else, they overcame their tensions during the making of Abbey Road, which isn't quite true. A few days before they were to begin recording, or perhaps even on the day they were to begin recording, John Lennon was driving a car and had a serious accident. Yoko Ono was in the car. Her daughter Kyoko was in the car. His son Julian was in the car. And Yoko was rather badly injured. The other Beatles went on to develop music during that time and to record it, but Lennon could not take part in it until later. And then when he did come into the studio, again, bringing Yoko Ono with him, others were there, such as Jeff Emmerich, the engineer who wrote a wonderful book about his life with the Beatles called Here, There, and Everywhere, and George Martin, the producer. They've all noted that with Lennon's return, a lot of the tension returned. Lennon was a dominating, strong personality. He could be quite intimidating, and he was clearly a moody person. He was probably the only person on earth up to that point that could really intimidate Paul McCartney. So the other Beatles were fearful when Lennon and Ono came back, and they were perplexed when Lennon brought in a huge bed to keep it right in the recording studio for Yoko, who had injured her back, and lowered a microphone over it so she could talk to him and the others when she felt like it. It was even one step further in what they had seen as her intrusion. But there were other tensions. Lennon did not want a conceptual piece on the album, or so he said later, though I think it's pretty clear that he participated not only willingly but enthusiastically at that time. He later said that he wanted his album, his songs on one side and McCartney's on the other side, which would not have worked as much of an album. He had a deep and rancorous arguments with McCartney during the sessions. Even though Lennon felt it was okay for himself to miss recording sessions, he did not feel it was okay for Paul to. And on one occasion when Paul failed to come to the session, Lennon drove over to his house, and they got into a pretty serious row in which Lennon broke apart a painting that he'd given McCartney as a present. So, there were some, the bitter divisions were not only still there, they were clearly growing. Now, the one person, all of this, who thought that the divisions could work to their benefit possibly, and rather the differences could work to their benefit possibly, was Paul McCartney. He still felt that they could function quite successfully as not only a creative unit, but as the domineering popular music unit of their time, but that wasn't to be.
Right. Well, finally, to sum up, and of course we could talk for hours about this, I'm enjoying it, but let me ask you to kind of blend your personal enthusiasm for this story with a bit of your sort of postscript about how you feel this story is important and interesting to continue to revisit. Because, I mean, some skeptics will say, oh, God, the Beatles on the cover of Rolling Stone again. You know, it's like, come on. Why is it important and interesting to keep revisiting this story?
Well, the subject of the Beatles, I admit, remains endlessly fascinating for me, and for various reasons. The music, of course, being a part of it. It's true that you can listen to an album 10, 20, 30, 100 times, and perhaps you're saturated with it, and that is true of a lot of music. And I could go the rest of my life without hearing a Beatles album and still know what that music was. But the greater part of their legacy is what they represented. The Beatles are kind of like they were a perfect storm. They were the right creative people at the right moment to hit the 1960s and to inspire not just musical creativity, but notions of change that became notions of politics, that became notions of power and dissension and cultural differences. Some of that was good and some of it was full of conflict. But they fit that progress pretty much every step of the way. Later, when they came apart, they were again the perfect storm for all those reasons, but those seemed like the internal reasons, the differences among them, the presence of Yoko Ono, the influence of Alan Klein, the economic worries, the musical philosophy that separated Lennon from McCartney. And yet, in the end, when you look back, it's clear that just as the Beatles had represented their time at their peak, they somewhat represented their time as things began to come apart. I mean, things really began to come apart for them much earlier than 1969. They certainly began to come apart in 1968. 1968 was a truly explosive year in the history of the modern world. It was a year of riots, rebellions, almost flat-out revolutions in Western Europe. And you can see those elements in the Beatles' music. By 1969, 1970, a lot of the hopefulness, a lot of the idealism that had driven youth in the 1960s was collapsing. The movements were turning into factions. Some factions were turning violent. The opposition to any change had become so powerful and so insurmountable that it drove many people to rage and revolt, sometimes understandably and sometimes foolishly. And I think something like that happened within the Beatles too. I don't think the Beatles could withstand, just as the Beatles made their times, I don't think they could withstand their times. They had a deep connection with the world outside them, whether they wanted to or not, and I think they clearly did not want to, but they both goaded the world and they reflected the world, and on a conscious level, they could not control all of that.